when their illegitimate interests are involved, even for a sick child who needs a bandage to heal their pain, they won't give it to them. We must know that there is a group called EB Home in Tehran, which deals with the condition of patients with epidermolysis bullosa, which is a type of skin disease. There are about 1,000 EB patients in Iran, and EB Home, which is a non-governmental organization, is responsible for handling their matters. They used to get special bandages for this skin disease from a European country that has the necessary standards for its production. When the American sanctions came, the Europeans complied. EB Home made a written request from them to provide these bandages to these sick children. They gave a written answer that they cannot give you these because of the sanctions. EB Home corresponded with its Turkish counterpart, requesting them to buy more bandages from the European country and send us the excess. When they made that request from that European country, they said that you have been receiving a certain amount until now. Why do you want more? Are you buying for another country like Iran? We cannot provide you with such items. Iran is sanctioned. I mean, this kind of view is really an experience. In my opinion, of course, it is a sad experience, but it was really an experience that Europeans do not care about the issue of human rights in any way. When the issue of their interests comes up, they sacrifice everything, not only human rights, but human beings. And they showed this in practice, because during this period, even a number of children suffering from special diseases, including EB, unfortunately died due to the lack of access to these drugs and medical equipment. As we, as the Islamic Republic of Iran, are claimant of these countries, and we consider them guilty and complicit in the killing of these innocent children.
Doctor, thank you so much for taking time for us. If there's anything left to say, please, we have a few minutes.
It's necessary to say, in order to complete the answer to your previous question, that on the subject of the sanctions lifting negotiations, which have continued in this administration from the very beginning and continue until now, is that the negotiations that are being carried out in the framework drawn up in the system of the Islamic Republic of Iran, based on the observance of its red lines, as well as meeting and providing the maximum interests of the Iranian nation. We entered these negotiations seriously right from the beginning, and now we're still serious in these negotiations. But as we have announced from the beginning, and the president has emphasized many times, and he is also paying special attention to the fact that the administration should emphasize that the fate of the country should not be tied to the fate of these negotiations, and the foreign policy of the 13th administration was not and is not based on negotiations, but negotiations are an important part of the administration's foreign policy, and we do not observe any procrastination or shortcoming in the path of negotiations by the administration seriously. The president has been personally following the issues of negotiations from the very beginning, and he still does. And he himself participates in some meetings, and they are organized in his presence. For this reason, the issue has been seriously pursued by the Islamic Republic of Iran and continues to be so. But the opposite party makes false excuses, as before, in pursuit of a series of goals beyond the negotiations. We have repeatedly announced that the Islamic Republic of Iran is ready to continue negotiations within the framework of the previous agreement, and we continue on this path. Now that I'm talking to you, we continue to interact with other parties, either through written messages or over the telephone, or sometimes through face-to-face negotiations. The process of negotiations has been divided into several parts, and it was the same before. But now it has become a bit more serious. And if each part has better conditions, that part will move forward. Since we have agreed not to release details to the media, I will not mention which sector is making more progress. But I can assure you that we are active in all three sectors in the field of negotiations. But some sectors have more tangible progress that we hope the synergy of the sectors together can bring a good and blessed end to the negotiations, and we will be able to conclude the negotiations in the foreseeable future.
و ما در آینده در واقع قابل پیش بینی بتونیم به جنبندی مذاکرات دست پیدا کنیم.
دکتر باقره‌کنی، thank you so much for joining us on Insight.
I also thank you and your viewers.
So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Dr. Baghari-Akani? Iran will inhibit a unique place in the emerging New World Order given its unique characteristics and its unique capabilities. Its homegrown power, both hard and soft, make it a significant actor in the emerging New World, capable of influencing events and punching above its weight to a much greater degree than some might want. With decades of sacrifice and jihad, Iranians showed that nations can have very significant independent social growth and development while resisting U.S. hegemony and economic war, and while maintaining sovereignty and strategic independence and their own cultural identity. Iran's message of not being an oppressor and not accepting oppression from anyone is a very attractive message for all liberated human beings from around the world. Human beings who experience the horrors of Western colonialism and imperialism, and who are now seeking to find their place in a new emerging post-US hegemonic world. As the US will seek to desperately and violently maintain what's left of its global hegemony, Iran's message and manifest example will inspire many nations to resist and to pursue national liberation and social growth beyond US hegemony. In many ways, the greatest barrier to the emergence of this new multipolar world are brainwashed elites, mostly in Europe, but also in other continents, and even some in Iran, who still believe it is the year 1995 and that nations cannot live and thrive without the US. A view that is now obsolete and even dangerous when we see how some European elites are sacrificing and destroying their own nations in order for the US to maintain its hegemony. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time, on Insight.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, you heard that 10 days after Imam Khomeini is going to Kuwait from Iraq and then leaving Kuwait immediately for France, his wife and family made preparations to join him in Paris. Before going to Paris, they held the martyrdom anniversary of the Imam's elder son, Haj Aqa Mustafa, and 4 days later left for Paris. Stay tuned for the rest of the story. The arrival of Imam Khomeini's wife, Lady Khadija Saqafi, in Paris was amazing and interesting to those who met her, as she was acquainted with French language. Haj Ahmad and some of the friends had come to the airport to welcome her. There was a student among them by the name of Nasreen Hakami, who was studying postgraduate in sociology. When the car carrying Miss Saqafi entered the streets of Paris, she started reading the signs. Some of her co-travelers were surprised, and Miss Hakami asked her if she knew French. The imam's wife answered that she had learned it before high school and continued, ironically, "Yet you shouldn't expect me to help you with your lessons." In those days, many religious families were opposed to women's education outside homes. The polite and sullen behavior of Ms. Saqafi attracted the neighbors and people in Neuf-le-Château village, in the outskirts of Paris. She used to stand up for guests and foresee them up the exit door. When the visitors saw her respectful, sincere, and plain conduct, they would be astonished and ask if she was the wife of the man who had staged a revolution in the world. Lady Khadija Saqafi, besides warm welcome and hospitality towards guests, used to answer their questions quite calmly and patiently. This would make people interested in her, and they would become curious to know more about Imam Khomeini and his movement. One of the women who had met Imam Khomeini's wife describes her as follows. She looked very stylish in the chocolate coat and skirt, which was set with her cream shirt. She had a flowery chador on her shoulders with a headscarf which was fit with her coat and shirt. She was sitting on the ground, and we asked her to sit on the chair. She said, "It would be very bad if you sit on the ground while I'm sitting on the chair." At last, our insistence made her to sit on the chair, but the shame on her face showed her humbleness and plainness very well. Some of the visitors would ask political questions from the imam's wife. This would make it a little difficult, as she had to answer the questions on the one hand, while avoiding answers which would cause the despotic regime in Iran to misuse the answers. Thus, she would answer some of the questions subtly and smartly. Sometimes she would say with a smile, "I am a political scholar's wife and not he himself." Some of the questions were about possible differences in her life with the imam. She would answer like this: "Both the imam and I reach an agreement in many differences, as we recognize differences of opinion, and very rarely do we dispute." Once she was asked if she was worried as her security was threatened. She answered, "Firstly, security is related with feeling. A part of it is real, while another part is the feeling that cowardly people would feel even if with 100 guards. Thank God the imam is so brave that there is no fear in our house in the light of his bravery. Moreover, naturally, I am not a coward." Imam Imam Khomeini's wife enjoyed lofty characteristics like her husband, and she didn't have any personal grudge against the Shah and his family. Thus, when the Shah was escaping from the country, she was impressed. Late Ms. Marzieh Hadidchi Dabbagh, who was in Paris in the last month of the Imam's stay, narrated an interesting account on this. The day when the Shah went, the sounds of people's joy and the slogans of death to the Shah were heard. The people in Neuville-le-Château, too, were happy. But when I said good night to the lady, Miss Safi, she was calm and quiet. And the next morning when she got up, there was no sign of joy in her face. I told her something to make her laugh. I said, "Lady, I congratulate you as the Shah has gone," she said. "We should congratulate you as you have been tortured in the prisons of Savak. But I wish this did not happen. I wish he had listened to the Imam's words in 1962 and had come to the nation so that he would not lose his popular support while going under the yoke of superpowers. I do not express happiness for the evil fate of anyone. I wish he had not become a Shah in the beginning and would not hear the chants of death to Shah these days. When I think of what a hard night he and his wife Farah are going to pass, I don't know what to say. I hope they will not commit any evil deed from now on so that their load of sins becomes heavier."
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The Russia-Ukraine war is about to enter its first anniversary within days. So far, thousands of people have been killed and many more displaced. Now, after nearly 1 year, the war has turned into a bigger conflict, an encounter, rather, between the West and Russia. Many countries, including the U.S., Germany, France, and the U.K., have been fanning the flames of the conflict by sending military aids worth billions of dollars. In the U.S., there has been a long debate among politicians on whether to support Kiev in its war with Russia. Some back the U.S. support for Ukraine. Others, however, take a different stance. Among them is Congressman Matt Gaetz. The Republican lawmaker has introduced a bill which calls for an immediate end to U.S. military and financial support for Ukraine. The resolution also urges the warring sides to negotiate a ceasefire.
How much more for Ukraine? Is there any limit? Which billionth dollar really kicks in the door? Which red line we set will we not later cross?
Throughout the war, Gaetz has been critical of U.S. support for Ukraine and has previously called for an end to the policy.
I will not vote for one more dollar to Ukraine. I will not vote for one more piece of materiel to Ukraine. We are far too entangled in this conflict. I believe we have extended this conflict. And I call on the Secretary of Defense to declassify the Inspector General report on the compliance with our existing regulations regarding chain of custody with materiel going to another country.
Gaetz has also taken a jab at President Joe Biden. In a statement on his resolution, Gaetz said President Joe Biden must have forgotten his prediction from March 2022, suggesting that arming Ukraine with military equipment will escalate the conflict to World War III. He added America is in a state of managed decline, and it will exacerbate if we continue to hemorrhage taxpayer dollars toward a foreign war. We must suspend all foreign aid for the war in Ukraine and demand that all combatants in this conflict reach a peace agreement immediately. Gates' resolution has so far received 10 co-sponsors, including Andy Biggs from Arizona, Lauren Boebert from Colorado, Marjorie Taylor Greene from Georgia, Anna Paulina Luna from Florida, Thomas Massey from Kentucky, and Mary Miller from Illinois. The bill introduced by Gates notes that the U.S. has already authorized over $110 billion to spend on the war in less than a year. The resolution comes after a series of escalations of U.S. military aid, including M1 Abrams tanks. It also comes at a time when Ukraine is seeking fighter jets from the U.S. and its allies. Each escalation risks a direct clash between Russia and NATO, which could quickly spiral into a nuclear war. But where does this rising U.S. opposition to continue aid to Ukraine come from? If U.S. taxpayers knew that half the income tax dollars that they sent to the Internal Revenue Service every year was being spent on weapons, war, and war preparation, political support for such programs might significantly decline. As a matter of fact, no agency of the federal government communicates to taxpayers how Congress spends their money. Purchasing weapons and military services with taxpayer dollars has always been, and continues to be, a highly profitable endeavor for defense contractors. But it is in a real war, like as in Ukraine, that such profiteering truly thrives. President Joe Biden's budget proposal to Congress for 2023 included $813 billion for the Pentagon and military expenditures. This is more than half the income taxes citizens send to the federal government each year, and a more than $31 billion increase over the already bloated fiscal year 2022 Pentagon budget. It is also more than the defense budgets of the eight next biggest military spenders put together, including Russia, China, and India. One of the components of the $782 billion Pentagon budget is for the purchase of new nuclear-armed submarines, even though the U.S. already has 14 lethal Ohio-class submarines, each capable of launching 192 nuclear warheads. Canceling two of these unnecessary and provocative new weapon systems would save more than $10 billion. All in all, what seems to be a non-negotiable is the U.S. taxpayers' money, which could and can be allocated to other needs. What seems to be clear, not only to American taxpayers, but to the whole world, is that the U.S. military-industrial complex is the only one who benefits most from such aid. Back in September 2022, a number of blasts occurred in the Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2 natural gas pipelines. Following the attacks, there were gas leaks around the pipelines, which were built to transport natural gas from Russia to Germany through the Baltic Sea. Both pipelines are majority owned by the Russian majority state-owned gas company Gazprom. Back then, there was much speculation about who may have been behind the sabotage act, but now a leading U.S. journalist has blamed the blast on the Washington regime. In a detailed report published in his blog, investigative journalist Seymour Hersh has claimed that the bombing of the Nord Stream underwater gas pipelines in the Baltic Sea was ordered by the White House and carried out by the CIA with the help of the U.S. Navy. Hersh says the finding is based on his own investigation into the September sabotage. He says U.S. Navy deep-sea divers planted the high-powered C-4 explosives under the gas pipelines under the guise of NATO naval exercises. The bombs were detonated on September 26th. With a remote signal sent by a sonar buoy, which was dropped near the Nord Stream pipelines by a Norwegian Navy P-8 surveillance plane. The planning process began back in December 2021, when a special task force was created with the direct participation of U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. The White House dismissed the report, but Russian officials say the published facts should become the basis for an international investigation. Russian Foreign Ministry says the United States has questions to answer over its alleged role in explosions. Earlier this month, Germany's public prosecutor general, Peter Frank, said that Berlin has no evidence linking Russia to the sabotage of the Nord Stream 1 and 2 gas pipelines. According to Hersh, the Biden administration was focused on Nord Stream pipelines because as long as European countries like Germany remained dependent on those pipelines for cheap natural gas, that would be reluctant to give military aid to Ukraine for a war with Russia, which was looming back then. The U.S. was a major opponent of the Nord Stream pipelines. In 2019, the former U.S. President Donald Trump said that Nord Stream 2 turned Europe into a hostage of Russia and placed sanctions on any company assisting Russia to complete the pipeline. In December 2020, then-President-elect Joe Biden expressed his opposition to the opening of the new pipeline.
If Russia invades, that means tanks or troops crossing the border of Ukraine again, then there will be no longer a Nord Stream 2. We will bring an end to it.
How will you do that exactly, since the project and control of the project is within Germany's control?
We will, I promise you, we'll be able to do it.
Swedish and Danish investigators have already found that the ruptures were a result of sabotage, but they have not specified who was responsible. The attacks occurred in exclusive economic zones of the two European countries. The 1,200-kilometer pipelines, operated by Russian gas giant Gazprom, are not currently in operation. Since the blast occurred, Moscow has blamed the West for the damage to the infrastructure. According to reports, the decision to undermine the Nord Stream 1 and 2 was agreed upon and approved personally by the U.S. President Joe Biden, and that he discussed the issue with his inner circle for more than 9 months.
Senator Cruz, like you, I am, and I think the administration is very gratified to know that Nord Stream 2 is now, as you like to say, a hunk of metal at the bottom of the sea.
The Russian government described the sabotage as a terrorist attack and said that the U.S. was the nation that benefited most from it by speeding up Europe's attempts to wean itself off Russian gas.
A devastating 7.8 magnitude earthquake struck southeastern Turkey and northwestern Syria early on Monday. The deadly quake and a string of aftershocks have killed thousands of people in both countries and injured more. Hundreds of buildings in both Syria and Turkey have been reduced to rubble. Rescue workers are still working in freezing temperatures to find those still trapped under debris. While Turkey has been aided by its allies and Western partners to cope with the crisis, aid is trickling to sanctions-hit Syria. Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad has highlighted Syria's need for humanitarian assistance, warning that the U.S. sanctions have worsened the circumstances as the illegal bans have prevented the delivery of everything to the country. The catastrophe of the earthquake that struck Syria is great, and what has increased its depth is a difficult circumstances that the country has been going through for the past 12 years as it's fighting terrorism and its supporters. What exacerbated the tragedy and catastrophe was the sanctions imposed by the United States and Western countries on Syria. The Syrian top diplomat further said that Damascus had appealed to the member states of the United Nations, the General Secretariat of the organization, its relevant agencies and funds, the International Committee of the Red Cross, and other humanitarian action partners from international, governmental and non-governmental organizations to extend a helping hand and support Syria's efforts to confront the crisis.
You know, given that the war situation and economic, financial, illegal, unilateral, inhumane Western sanctions imposed on Syria, at the same time when the U.S. Is imposing, and with its Western allies, imposing almost a blockade around Syria.
As Syria is reeling from the aftermath of the deadly earthquakes, the United States is working with partners to provide earthquake relief in Syria, but will stand firm against working with Syria's legitimate government headed by President Bashar al-Assad. The United States has refused normalization of relations with the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad or any direct reconstruction aid.
Lots of the aeroplane, cargo aeroplane, refused to land on Syrian airports because of the American and European sanctions. So even those countries who want to send humanitarian assistance, they cannot use the aeroplane cargo because of the sanctions.
Washington listed Syria as a state sponsor of terrorism in 1979, but since the beginning of the imposed war on Syria in 2011, the United States and its Western allies have imposed a number of economic sanctions and restrictions on Syria. U.S. sanctions intensified with the passing of the CISA Act in 2019, which was signed by former President Donald Trump. The sanctions have severely affected the Syrian economy, especially its construction, finance and energy sectors, and complicated the reconstruction effort.
The hurdles we have, if I talk about the area under government control, we don't have an access problem in terms of authorizations, but we have an access problem in terms of the capacity of the infrastructure to authorize to enable us to do it. I mean, this means we might have to repair a few roads here and there. And we're not the only one. The government is also working on that. But we are in a situation where it was already difficult to do that before. And now we are in a situation where we don't have any other option than doing it.
Syria has been in the throes of foreign-backed militancy since March 2011. While the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group was crushed by the Syrian government, militant outfits continue to hold sway in some parts of the country under the patronage of Western powers. The United States has also established several military bases in northern Syria in a bid to help the terrorists there. Meanwhile, Iran has sent several batches of humanitarian aid to Syria to help the Arab country deal with the aftermath of the devastating earthquakes. The latest batch of aid included food, blankets, and carpets. Iran will send more humanitarian supplies to Syria in the coming days. Iran has urged the international community to put pressure on the U.S. to lift its cruel sanctions on Syria to facilitate aid deliveries. The Lebanese Hezbollah resistance movement has also sent convoys of humanitarian aid to earthquake-affected areas in Syria.
One of Joe Biden's promises during his presidential campaign was to immediately move to end all support for the Saudi-led coalition's war in Yemen. In February 2021, Biden stood at a podium at the State Department and proclaimed that the war in Yemen must end. Biden underlined the humanitarian crisis as the key reason the United States withdrew support.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
An investigation by the Government Accountability Office found that the United States is training the Saudi-led coalition and the U.S. has troops on the ground in Yemen. Biden confirmed that the United States has troops in Yemen in a letter to Congress in June last year. Simply put, he lied to the world when he claimed that the United States was withdrawing U.S. troops for the war in Yemen in 2021. On the contrary, the United States is making billions of dollars from the war in Yemen, as 200,000 have been killed from direct violence. According to data acquired from the Defense Security Cooperation Agency, between 2015 and 2021, the United States sent $54.2 billion in weapons and services to Saudi Arabia and the UAE. In addition, the Department of Defense provided $644 million for military training to Saudi Arabia and the UAE, almost entirely through the Foreign Military Sales Program. The DoD uses acquisition and cross-servicing agreements to bill nations for logistical support and items ranging from flying hours, fuel, and bombs. Saudi Arabia paid the United States $157 million in flying hours, and the UAE paid $104 million for flying hours since the Saudi-led intervention began in Yemen in 2015. The United States billed Saudi Arabia and the UAE for $319 million in acquisition and cross-servicing agreements for logistical support. Also, the United States sent $18.6 billion in missiles, $6.2 billion in aircraft, $3.3 billion in ships, and $2.8 billion in military training to attack one of the poorest nations in the world. The United States is well aware that the coalition is not fighting an advanced military in Yemen. Billions of dollars have been spent destroying the country, killing hundreds of thousands of people. The UN Security Council approved a resolution to blockade Yemen since 2015 to prevent arms from flooding the conflict. However, the embargo has only succeeded in starving the Yemenis into famine. On a February 9th phone call in 2022 with the King of Saudi Arabia, Salman bin Abdulaziz Al Saud, Biden assured him that the United States would continue to support the war in Yemen. The phone call came 1 year after Biden lied to the world and announced that the U.S. was withdrawing its support of the war in Yemen. The Defense Security Cooperation Agency's Defense Institute of International Legal Studies conducted training at the Saudi War College that focused on the law of armed conflict, including laws related to air-to-ground targeting in May 2017, April 2018, June 2019, and May 2020. The DoD claims they are not responsible for civilian deaths because they provided the Saudis with training to avoid civilian casualties. According to the Yemen Data Project, over 23,000 Saudi-led coalition airstrikes since March 2015 have led to thousands of civilian casualties. A Yemeni human rights organization has warned that the Saudi-led war on Yemen, as well as the crippling siege in the impoverished Arab country, could result in the death of thousands of children suffering from cancer. Intisaf, Organization for Women's and Children's Rights, said in a statement on the occasion of World Cancer Day that more than 3,000 Yemeni children who have developed cancer as a result of Saudi aggression and the tight sea, land, and air blockade on the country are now at significant risk of death. The rights group criticized the international organizations and other relevant bodies for neglecting Yemeni cancer patients over the past years. Intisaf added that the incidence of leukemia is increasing among Yemeni children, saying the cases of kids suffering from blood cancer have soared from 300 to 700 in the capital Sana'a due to the use of internationally banned weapons supplied by the United States and the United Kingdom and used by Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. Approximately 1,000 children are also believed to have contracted leukemia in other Yemeni regions due to the same reasons. The rights organization pointed to the dire shortage of medicine needed for the treatment of patients diagnosed with cancer because of the Saudi-led military onslaught and siege, stating that many children lose their lives as a result. The human rights organization noted that the economic hardships caused by the ongoing military aggression and blockade have prevented minor cancer patients from seeking treatment abroad, calling for the opening of Sana'a International Airport for humanitarian purposes. It finally held Saudi Arabia and its allies fully responsible for all crimes and violations being perpetrated against the Yemeni nation, especially children, urging the international community to bear the legal and humanitarian responsibility for the violations against the civilians. Saudi Arabia, in collaboration with its Arab allies and with arms and logistics support from the US and other Western states, launched a devastating war in Yemen in March 2015. The objective was to crush the popular Ansarullah resistance movement, which has been running state affairs in the absence of a functional government in Yemen, and reinstalled the Riyadh-friendly regime of Abd Rabbu Mansur Hadi. The Saudi-led coalition has failed to achieve any of its objectives, leaving hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and spawning the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sador Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
According to the U.S. media, the level of suicide among American youth is devastating. The suicide rate in the United States has increased by about 30% from 2000 to 2018, and this is the highest suicide rate among the rich countries of the world. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The CNN cable news network has covered this story and tells us more. The U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, has released data showing an increase in suicide rate in the United States. CDC data showed on Friday, 10th of February, that after a two-year decline in the number of suicides, those deaths went back up in 2021. The data showed that 48,183 people in the U.S. committed suicide in 2021, indicating a year-on-year rise compared to 45,979 deaths in 2020 and 47,511 deaths in 2019. CDC reported that the record high for suicides in a single year came in 2018 when 48,344 Americans took their own lives. The report noted that there was a disparity between the different races and age groups in the United States, and the number of suicides among the youth and black Americans was significantly higher than others. The CDC specifically pointed out that the number of young black Americans who have committed suicide over the most recent three-year period was alarming. The report stated suicide rates among persons aged 10 to 24 years increased significantly during 2018 to 2021, particularly among black persons, from 8.2 to 11.2, a 36.6% increase. The report noted that particular concern with younger black Americans is mirrored among the 25 to 44-year-old age group of different ethnic groups. Hispanics also saw a 19.4% jump, while suicides for non-Hispanic multiracial Americans in that age range rose by 20.6% over the same time period. Julie Goldstein Grummet, Vice President and Director of the Zero Suicide Institute at the Education Development Center, told Yahoo News, "It's much more helpful to understand data at this segmented level because it really helps us to design the right research and the right interventions for the future." She called the figures disheartening, adding, "It's challenging to realize that in some populations, suicide is just growing so exponentially. In the meantime, suicide is four times higher in men compared to women. Experts attribute this to the fact that men are more likely to use lethal means and have more difficulty in seeking mental help. The Center for Disease Control, the CDC, data fails to provide a breakdown of the deceased by their social status and level of income. In the United States, suicides have been cited as a leading cause of death. USA Today has also covered this story and tells us more. A federal analysis found suicide rates increased and disparities widened in 2021, returning to pre-pandemic rates after 2 years of decline. Notably, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC's analysis, found the rate of suicide among American Indian and Alaska Native people increased 26% from 2018. Followed by Black and Hispanic people, who saw 19.2% and 6.8% increases respectively. CDC researchers said the data raises concerns over access to care and pandemic struggles. The lead author of the report, Deborah M. Stone, told USA Today, "We know that certain groups have been already disadvantaged and have had inequities in suicide risk during COVID-19. These increases are very concerning and point to the need for really some dedicated prevention efforts targeting those racial and ethnic minority groups using culturally relevant programs." The CDC analysis released recently compared rates from 2018 to 2021. In 2021, 48,183 people died by suicide. According to the report, that year the overall age-adjusted suicide rate rose to 14.1 deaths for every 100,000 of the population, returning to the peak seen in 2018 of 14.2 deaths per 100,000 population. In 2020, the rate was 13.5 deaths per 100,000 population. American Indian and Alaska Native people had the highest age-adjusted suicide rates at 28.1 per 100,000 of the population, up from 22.3 in 2018. Suicide rates among Black people increased from 7.3 to 8.7 per 100,000 of the population. Among Hispanic people, the suicide rate increased from 7.4 to 7.9 per 100,000. Black children and youth aged between 10 and 24 saw the highest increase, 36.6% of all age groups and racial groups measured. American Indian and Alaska Native people aged between 25 and 44 saw a 33.7% increase. Asian people saw a 1.5% relative increase, which the report noted was not statistically significant. White people were the only group that saw an overall decline of almost 4% compared to 2018. The suicide rate was 17.4 deaths per 100,000 in 2021. The lead author of the report, Stone, and her colleagues wrote suicide rates might be stable or even decline during a disaster, only to rise again afterwards. As the nation continues to respond to the short and long-term impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic, remaining vigilant in prevention efforts is critical, especially among disproportionately affected populations, where longer-term impacts might compound pre-existing inequities in suicide risk. CBS News has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to estimates published by the CDC's National Center for Health Statistics, preliminary data suggests suicide rates in the United States had not significantly improved overall through the first quarter of 2022. However, rates varied widely in several states for 2022 compared to 2021. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, has long tracked disparities in rates of suicide. In 2020, even as suicide rates declined amid the first year of the pandemic overall, the agency had found suicide increasing among Hispanic men and non-Hispanic multiracial women. The report's authors wrote, "Suicide is a complex problem related to multiple risk factors such as relationship, job or school, and financial problems, as well as mental illness, substance abuse, social isolation, historical trauma, barriers to healthcare, and easy access to lethal means of suicide among persons at risk." Citing an analysis published in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, the authors also cautioned that suicide rates have been seen rising after other disasters, even after appearing to immediately plateau or fall. The authors of the report wrote, "As the nation continues to respond to the short and long-term impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic, remaining vigilant in prevention efforts is critical, especially among disproportionately affected populations where longer-term impacts might compound pre-existing inequities in the suicide risk." The report breaks down the data only by age and gender, but previous CDC data has shown that some groups are more vulnerable than others, including Native Americans, veterans, and those living in rural areas. Mental health has also deteriorated significantly among the youth during the pandemic, with more than 40% of teenagers saying they persistently felt sad or hopeless during the past year. Major pediatric health groups have declared a national state of emergency in children's mental health. The new national suicide hotline, 988, saw a 45% spike in calls in the first week after its introduction in July of 2022.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The second phase of the revolution statement addressed to the Iranian nation on the occasion of the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. In its first step, the revolution turned the disgraceful regime and the tyrannical monarchy into a popular and democratic state and employed the element of national determination, which is the essence of comprehensive and genuine progress, to the heart of the country's governance. Then it turned the youth into the main forerunners of the developments and the key players in the management of the country. It conveyed the message of we can do it spirit and belief to everyone. Thanks to the enemy's sanctions, it taught everyone to rely on domestic capacities, and this unfolded a source of great blessings.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Firstly, it guaranteed the stability and security of the country. the territorial integrity, and the protection of the borders which were targeted by the enemy's Syria threats, and gave rise to the miracle of the victory in the eight-year war, leading to the defeat of the Ba'athist regime and its American, European, and Eastern supporters. Secondly, it acted as the country's regime in developing the field of science and technology, and in creating the vital economic and constructional infrastructures which continue to grow more prevalent day by day. Several thousands of knowledge enterprises, several thousands of infrastructure and necessary projects for the country in the areas of civil engineering and transportation, industry, power, mining, healthcare, agriculture, and water, millions of universities, graduates, or students, thousands of colleges and universities throughout the country, dozens of big projects such as the nuclear fuel cycle, stem cells, nanotechnology, biotechnology, etc., all ranking among the top of the world, developing 60 times more non-oil exports and nearly 10 times more industrial units. The quality of the industrial sector advanced tens of times more than before. The industry that only relied on assembling and montage was transformed into domestic technology.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahan Abbott, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
On Saturday, protests were held in front of the Italian state broadcaster Rai's premises in a number of cities, including Rome, Milan, and Naples. The protests had been called against the Rai's decision to read out a message by Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky during the final night of Italy's biggest entertainment TV show of the year, a song contest, which brings millions of viewers together.
We are here today to remind our politicians the suffering we had to go through for decades after World War II. This man in the photo is my grandfather. He died during that war. We are against the bellicose propaganda broadcast on state TV.
Earlier this week, state broadcaster Rai opted to withdraw a planned video address by Zelensky at the popular TV show and replace it with the reading of a message sent by the Ukrainian leader.
I would have preferred Zelensky to have been present at the TV show. I've appreciated his decision to send a written message and, above all, I'm sorry about the controversy that was stirred up.
We say no to the politicization of culture, no to Zelensky on our TV shows, no to a man who is leading his